This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Professor Ilan Pape is an Israeli academic and activist who is one of the new historians from Israel who has changed the official Zionist version of the Palestinian-Israeli situation. Currently a professor at the University of Exeter in the UK, where he is the director of the European Centre for Palestine Studies. He has publicly spoken out against Israel's policies and condemned the Israeli occupation and apartheid regime. And he joins me now to share why, and also why he is calling for the international community to take action against Israel's Zionist policies. Welcome, Professor. How are you today?
Fine, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. So just to get to know you a little bit better, Professor, I know you were born in Israel, but you pretty much had to move to England as it was necessary for your safety and your survival. So I understand that you had supported an academic boycott on Israel's universities. I mean, could you share that story with us?
Definitely. Until 2006, I was teaching at the University of Haifa. And in 2006, for various reasons, one of them is my support for the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement. The other was my insistence on teaching a certain version of history that the official narrative did not accept. So I was kicked out of the Israeli academia. So my main reason for moving to the United Kingdom was for continuing an academic career, which I couldn't do in Israel. Mm-hmm. And I was offered a position, thank God, in England. Also for various kind of threats on my family and so on, we went out and back and out. Mm-hmm. So we commute rather intensively between the two places. But academically, I needed to go out in order to continue freely my research and teaching on the Palestine issue.
Mm-hmm. How was it like for you to have lived in Israel at the same time be against the state? Were you branded a traitor? And I mean, what were some of the other consequences, you know, to you?
Yeah, definitely. It's not an easy stance to take when you are challenging the basic truisms that your society believe in. And it takes, first of all, the journey you have to do is to liberate yourself, because I was also indoctrinated in such a way. But I think once there is a moment where you reach kind of a juncture where you know you cannot go back anymore because you know too much.
That's right.
Then you are at peace with yourself, and you can withstand any kind of consequences that your actions may bring with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that moment came in 2007, 2006, especially after I wrote my book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, which described in full what happened in 48. And once this was exposed to me and others, I think, like me, we could not go back. And despite being labeled as a traitor or whatever other kind of accusation were cast against you, you feel very confident that what you're doing is not only good and right for you, but you're actually working on behalf of the same people who hate you, that you're also thinking about them.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they cannot see it right now.
Yeah, and hopefully, I mean, that's why you're doing the work that you're doing, right?
Absolutely.
Hopefully they will see that. So, I mean, in that book that you just mentioned, you know, you argued that the establishment of the Israeli state in 1948 formed part of a plan to ethnically cleanse the indigenous population of Palestine. And you also argued that this plan remains one of Israel's fundamental policies today. What led you to those conclusions, and sort of, I mean, what proof did you have to make those claims?
For a while, although this is not true today anymore, but for a while, the Israeli government declassified documents about 1948, and they did it about 30 years after the event.
Uh-huh.
So the first kind of impulse to change the narrative came from the exposure of new evidence. For me, I don't think Palestinian refugees needed evidence that they were ethnically cleansed, but I needed evidence that this was a planned action and not, you know, just the consequence of a war, as we were told.
Yeah.
And the documents are very clear. They're very clear that there is a master plan long before 48 to get as much of as of Palestine as possible and to get rid of the Palestinians who live in that those parts in Palestine that would become a Jewish state.
That's right.
And as time passes by, you understand that Israel actually was a typical settler colonial project, very much like the white settler colonial project in North America and Australia, where there, unfortunately, the natives were genocided.
Yeah.
In Palestine, the method of getting a new country to a settlers' movement was ethnically cleansing them. And because it was an incomplete ethnic cleansing in 48, although half of Palestine's population was expelled, but still half remained on the land, mm-hmm. and the refugees formed a national liberation movement. Because of that, the kind of settler colonial logic of getting rid of the native is still part of the DNA of the whole Israeli regime and identity. And it continues, and it explains almost every action Israel took against the Palestinians from 1948 until today.
Mm-hmm. And when you presented this, you know, I mean, I can imagine that the reactions would have been quite catastrophic, actually, for you, especially, yeah. you know. And how did you sort of field all that that criticism that was leveled at you? I'm sure you were branded, again, a traitor and, yeah. you know, just changing history, perhaps?
Well, to my great surprise, if one has time to explain, even to an ardent Zionist, if you have time to explain, as sometimes I do, from the beginning, the historical context and so on, people get confused and, mm-hmm. and you push them in the right direction. I think the main effort of the Israeli government was to not to allow people like myself to have the time.
That's, or to have the platform.
Exactly, the platform. I think once you have the platform, people can change mm-hmm. because, as I said, the evidence is black and white. It's very clear. Of course, you can take a moral position and say, I don't care if people were kicked or massacred. But most people do, and Israelis are not different from any other human creed we know. So I think the problem there is really information and access to information. And therefore, you take almost for granted that people at first would react very angrily and, mm-hmm. and call you names. But I think once you cross this threshold and you have more time to explain, it becomes easier to have a more constructive dialogue. But the problem is to have the platform for that, as you say. Yeah,
mm-hmm. But well,
that's right.
That's why we're having you here, so that
right.
you can
Thank you.
But, you know, before we get into that also, I was reading from previous interviews that you've given that, you know, from very early on in your career as a professional historian, you were interested in non-elite history.
That's right.
Right? And I mean, what best describes non-elite history to someone who doesn't understand that? And, yeah. you know, why were you particularly interested in this approach?
Yeah. I think when you start reading history and study history, you realize that until very recently, what most of the world called history was the history of white men.
The winners.
No women. It was his story, mm-hmm. not her story, not their story. And so many groups, whether gender groups or people, you know, native people, indigenous people, non-Western people. Mm-hmm. And then in the Western society, people who were workers and laborers and farmers. Such a large group of humanity was not included in the historical narrative. So if you have some sort of sensitivity in you, you want to tell a more total history.
Of course.
So that was the first impulse. And then you move to your own country and you see who is included and who is excluded. And it starts with the question, who tells the history?
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that the Palestinians as a group are totally excluded from that story. And within the Palestinian society, again, it's the non-elites which are not even being referred to,
mm-hmm.
and also in the Jewish society, you know. Jews who came from Arab countries uh-huh. are not regarded in Israel in the same way as Jews who came from European countries. They are regarded as inferior culturally and socially, and therefore also they suffer economically. So all these, I thought it was a very important departure point to show people that injustice affects a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they think that they are on the winning side, it can affect them as well. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was very important for me.
And how did you go about, you know, gaining those perspectives?
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of it has to do with making sure that as an academic you don't stay in the ivory tower, that you are all the time connected to society. Mm. And a lot of academics forget this. They tend to focus on their career, and they forget why at all they were supposed to be studying history, sociology, anthropology, it doesn't matter, economics. I think I always made a point of being an activist as well as an academic. Mm. And if you are at that level all the time, you can never forget about the other groups. You can't be an elitist if you work with the people and not just above the people. And I think that was very important for me.
Okay. And I guess, you know, it helps you to explain sort of that relationship between these sorts of narrative discourses and historical representation, right? To present these sorts of views as well.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not easy, because in the West for a long time, historians claim to be objective and unbiased. And if you tell them that actually who you are impacts the story you tell, they would say, no, I'm the only thing that tells my story are the documents, the facts. And you say, no, it's a triangle. Mm. There is the evidence, and there is you, and there is the story. And you are as important as the evidence. And this is another struggle I had to go through. I sometimes felt in the Israeli academia that some of the animosity was not caused only by challenging the Zionist narrative, by challenging the scientific nature of the project of writing history in the academia was as outrageous in their eyes as challenging the Zionist project. But I think it goes together. We need to understand how historical narratives are being spanned and what how they are constructed. And I think that's very important, because you want to tell a story which would allow you to live better in the future. So you have to understand how history is abused as well as how it is used, you know? And I think that always allowed me to be in contact with a lot of groups within the society who felt that their narratives were never heard or were distorted, you know?
I'm speaking today to Professor Ilan Pape. He's a historian and he's a social activist. He's the director of the European Center for Palestinian Studies at the University of Exeter. And we're discussing his work, you know, in reframing the whole Israeli-Palestine conflict. And we're going to continue that discussion after this quick break. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs, and in the studio with me today is Professor Ilan Pape. He's a historian and activist. He's the director of the European Center for Palestinian Studies at the University of Exeter, and we are talking about how he is working towards reframing the Israeli-Palestine conflict. So, Professor, you know, one of the other things that you've debunked, and I think you've written a book about it, you know, debunking all the core myths of Israel. And one of that was the War of 1967, which, you know, they said was a war of no choice. Why did they say that? And, you know, why do you think that was a myth?
Yeah, I think especially with regard to the occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, which became one of the major points of contention and the main source of the conflict today, it was very clear that this idea that Israel should expand beyond the territories it occupied in 1948, Israel occupied only about 80% of historical Palestine. Mm-hmm. And this is Israel without the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
That's right.
And there was always a desire after 48 to take over the whole of historical Palestine. And they were just looking for the right historical opportunity. So what I show in the book is that actually in 1967, they didn't have to occupy the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, but they exploited very well the circumstances of the great tension between Israel and Egypt and Israel and Syria to initiate a war in order to take over the rest of Palestine. Mm-hmm. And of course, even after they occupied Palestine, they could have the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, they could have withdrawn very quickly if they wanted to. But this was the whole notion of Zionism. You take as much of the land as you can without the people. Mm-hmm. Their hesitation with regard to 67 was that after they kicked out 1 million Palestinians, they were about to get the territory they wanted, but an additional number of Palestinians. And what I claim in my book, The Biggest Prison on Earth, is that they solved the dilemma of how to have the land without the people, but without expelling the people through a very vicious and ruthless regime of control, which has different layers. And people who follow the realities in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip know how these realities are being translated into daily life of the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. But all in all, it's a very strict military rule over the life of millions of Palestinians who are bereft of any basic human and civil rights. And I think that's the most important fact to take, or conclusion to take, from the 67, or the result of the 67 war, because this explains, and I'm sure we'll talk about it a bit later, but this explains why the peace process could never succeed, because it ignored the fact that actually for Israel, the peace process is part of that same system that would allow it to have the land without the people, in this modern version of ethnic cleansing, where you don't kick out the people physically, but you wipe them out as citizens with rights and so on.
And this is
a strategy. This is not a tactic. It's a strategy from the very beginning. And it has been going on now for 52 years. Mm-hmm. And Israel has been rebuked maybe in certain quarters in the world, but not enough apparently for them to think of altering the system.
Yeah. Well, I suppose if they have enough support, I mean, why would they, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, you know, going on what you were saying, you've examined what is known as the two-state solution, correct?
That's right.
And you concluded that it's not viable. You are actually in support of a one-state solution.
That's
I mean,
right.
Could you help unpack that for people?
Yeah,
who don't quite know?
Definitely. The whole idea of partition is a colonialist idea. Mm-hmm. And whenever you look back at the history of Palestine, from the first time partition was properly introduced by the United Nations in 1947 as a solution, two things are important to remember. A, that the native indigenous people have no wish whatsoever to partition their land with settlers, colonialist settlers.
Why would they?
Exactly. And that the international community, for some reason, always thought that the Jewish settlers should have more of the land than the Palestinians. So even when the Palestinians were beginning to say, you know, out of necessity, we'll accept partition, maybe with the hope that one day they could reunite the country, they were always offered a very small portion of the land. Mm-hmm. Now, because of the imbalance of power, and I can understand it, the Palestinian National Movement eventually in the 1980s, and that led to the Oslo Accord, said, okay, we better salvage something out of Palestine. So they thought that maybe if they agree to partitioning Palestine and get the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, which I should remind your listener is just 20% of their homeland, maybe at least there they could build or express their right for self-determination. But had they, which they didn't, had they understood well the Israeli DNA and the ideological makeup of Israel, they would understand that for Israelis, the idea was to create a Bantustan, a kind of an autonomy protectorate under Israeli control that if it behaves well, can remain autonomous. And if it doesn't, as we can see in the case of the Gaza Strip, it will feel the might of the Israeli army. So two states is an idea that can only survive with the Israeli interpretation. And the Israeli interpretation makes the two-state solution just another method of implementing the ethnic cleansing that they have started in 48. So we have to actually wipe it out as a solution and rethink about a different way of changing, reframing the relationship between the settler community, the Jewish community, and the native community, the indigenous people. Mm-hmm. Maybe there was a moment in 67 when not one Jewish settler was moved into the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Maybe there was a short moment where you could create something that looked like a sovereign Palestinian state. But Israel never wanted to allow it to happen. If Israel doesn't allow it to happen, it wouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to rethink the whole issue altogether.
I mean, that sounds quite impossible to do, almost.
It does, but I think is in order to have a proper kind of struggle that adapts to the 21st century, you have to get rid of the slogans that didn't work, you know. there is a paradigm the two-state paradigm is the paradigm of parity. If we have here two equal sides and all you need is to partition the land between them. Mm-hmm. We've tried it for 52 years. It doesn't work for the reasons I've just mentioned. So we need to think about a different paradigm. For me, the paradigm is a regime change because there is one state solution already. Israel controls the whole of historical Palestine, mm-hmm. but in an undemocratic way.
That's right.
So the only way to move forward is to make it a democracy, a real democracy, with equal rights to both sides and to rectify past evils by allowing the refugees to return and get back some of the land that Israel robbed of the Palestinians. But in order to start the conversation about it, you need people to accept that the two-state solution is a dead solution, and we need to go back to the desk and prepare a new idea, which will benefit everyone in the end of the day.
Right, because as it stands, that two-state solution is still the solution that is being...
Everybody is talking about, including the Palestinian leadership. Oh. And once this is there, you cannot push forward alternative ideas. Mm. I always say that the two-state solution is a dead body that has been lying in the morgue for more than 2 years, but nobody has invited us to the funeral.
Okay.
So, and we need to have a closure on that. It won't be easy because there's still some people in the West, occupied West Bank, for instance, who's saying, yes, at least it will get the Israeli army out of our life. One can understand it after 52 years of ruthless occupation, but it won't. The issue is that it won't get the Israelis out of their life. If Israel remains as it is, a Zionist state, Palestinians would remain oppressed, mm-hmm. whether within a Bantustan or whether under direct occupation. And we want to, this is the main thing we want to change, this inequality between half of the population that lives in historical Palestine and the other half mm-hmm. that have all the privileges.
It's strange, right? I mean, everyone living in that same area, but half the population having everything, all the rights, and another half treated like strangers in their own country.
Exactly, like aliens in their own country, which is very typical to settler colonial projects. If you look at how the white settlers treated the native population in North America and Australia, you could see that for them, they thought that they were the indigenous people and the indigenous people were the aliens. This is not, Israel has not invented anything in this respect. What is particular to Israel is that this situation is not recognized in most of the countries of the West, mm-hmm. The Western world, where they regard Israel as the only democracy in the Middle East, despite the fact that half of the population is under its control has no rights whatsoever. To call such a country the only democracy in the Middle East would, force us to change the books on democracy, because that's not what I understand democratic countries to be like. Yeah.
So, I mean, in your opinion, what does the international community need to do more, do we need to do more than just condemn the settlements? What more can we do
I think the international community eventually would have to treat Israel as it treated apartheid South Africa. I know we're far, far away from that. Even governments in this part of the world, Southeast Asia, because of strategic reasons, military reasons, economic reasons, do not dare to challenge Israel as a state. Some of them do it because they want to remain with good relationship with the United States, mm-hmm. and so on. So I think at this moment in time, we have very little confidence in the power of governments to change their policies. But we are doing quite a good work among civil societies, even in places like the United States, mm-hmm. where especially among the younger generation, and maybe because of the internet, there's a much more awareness of what goes on. You cannot hide anymore, I think, situations like the one in Palestine. Mm-hmm. And there is a growing understanding among young people around the world that Israel is a rogue country in this respect, in the way that it treats the Palestinians. And the Palestinians don't have the power to change it by themselves. They're too weak mm-hmm. to do it. The imbalance of power is against them. And that, supports solidarity from the civil society may eventually bring also to change of policies from above. We have to remember also in the case of apartheid South Africa, you needed to drag the government screaming into imposing sanctions.
Yeah.
They didn't want to impose sanctions on South Africa. And it was the civil society that eventually pressured the government to take a more active role in changing the reality mm-hmm. on the ground.
And I think the media also plays a role, right? Because I think US-backed media, a lot of it, or government-backed US media, they present only one side of the story, which is, of course, the Israeli story. And that's a very powerful one. But thankfully now, as you said, you know, with the internet, with social media, all these different narratives are coming in. So it's that non-elite history, non-elite narratives also coming to light.
Absolutely. And the mainstream media also has another problem. I mean, apart from the fact that much of it, especially in the West, is pro-Israeli to begin with, mm-hmm. and therefore would not allow the Palestinian narrative to be heard. One also have to say that most of the mainstream media doesn't have the patience for contextualizing.
Uh-huh.
As I say, you cannot with a soundbite explain Palestine. Because on the face of it, the Israeli point of view would look reasonable.
That's right.
You know, we want to partition the land. We're the democratic side. They are the non-democratic side.
Mm-hmm.
It works well in a soundbite. But once you unpack it through the history of the ethnic cleansing and you show that the ethnic cleansing continues today in every corner of Palestine. But you need space for this.
Mm.
And I think one of our major challenges with the mainstream media is to have this space. And the Israelis are aware of it and they're making everything possible so that we won't have that space. But I think eventually the mainstream media, like the mainstream academia, would change. But it's a long struggle. And the problem is that on the ground, you know, there are two clocks working here, the clock of destruction
mm.
and the clock of changing people's minds. And the clock of destruction is much faster. And therefore, Palestinians are on the ground, are frustrated. Even if you tell them of successes in changing public opinion, they rightly say, but it has no bearing on our life.
Oh, daily life.
I say, as yet, but I'm not there. I'm not in their shoes. And it's very difficult to wait for the change if it's not coming.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, some of it has actually resulted, I suppose, violence as a form of resistance.
Absolutely.
As well, right?
Absolutely.
And that is, of course, the narrative that the Israeli army will use for their retaliation and their power,
exactly.
the acts of power, right?
Exactly. Yeah, and you can understand where this violence comes from, but you also understand it's a pretext for Israel to inflict even more violence.
Exactly.
It's a vicious circle, and that's why we need an international and regional interference
mm-hmm.
Because otherwise this vicious circle will continue.
Well, I mean, one international movement, which I know you are a supporter of, is the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions
right.
movement. I mean, tell me why you think this campaign actually can be an effective instrument against
yeah.
Israeli occupation.
Yeah. I think the for a lot of Israelis, living in Israel as a legitimate place is important.
Mm-hmm.
A state like Israel sort of rests on two pillars. There is a material pillar. This is the military power, the economic power, the high-tech power. You don't need legitimacy for that.
Mm.
You just need to be powerful, and they're very powerful. And therefore, they will remain, I think, exist for a long time. But for many Israelis, this is not enough. They want to have a moral foundation. And I think what the BDS does, first of all, is to challenge the morality of the state and its policies. And it's very easy to do this because the facts are very clear here, you know. Eventually, I think it also affects the economic relationship that the world has with Israel. And that also starts to undermine the material pillar. So I think it's a non-violent, effective way to help. It's not the only thing that would change the reality. You need a united Palestinian resistance movement, which we don't have yet, mm-hmm. unfortunately. You need a clear Palestinian vision of the solution, and we don't have it, which mm-hmm. is very difficult. And you need a change from within the Jewish society, which we're working on and is not happening. But I think it's part of that triangle, three kind of pressures
mm-hmm.
that eventually would change. And it's working quite well. And it worked well in the case of South Africa, which is the main inspiration, I think, for this.
Mm-hmm.
And more than anything else, I would say, solidarity usually means that you don't tell people what they should do. You ask them, what can you do for them?
Mm-hmm.
And this was a call from the Palestinian civil society on us in the world or in Israel or wherever. Support us with this movement. because we need that in order to move forward. And it's a reasonable request. And it was very easy to heed the request and respond favorably to it.
And it's simple enough for anybody to do as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And it's not the kind of a dictatorship, you know. It's like people can use their own imagination and their own knowledge of their own society how to do it.
Mm.
What you can do in Malaysia may be different from what you can do in Germany because of the sensitivities there. But there's a lot of things you can do in Germany as well.
That's right.
So I think every group of activists around the world has its own kind of BDS understanding. And that's why it's spreading so quickly. And that's why it's so successful, I think. But it needs to be more effective, that's for sure. I come back to the point that when I go back to Palestine tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, people will say to me, okay, you've been to Malaysia. We appreciate it, but yesterday was worse than the day before and tomorrow will be worse than today. So apparently we're doing a lot, but maybe not enough.
Yeah, but I mean, it did kind of strike fear in the Israeli government, didn't they? I remember talking to Saul Takahashi, I think, and he said that the Israeli government actually formed a whole sort of...
A whole ministry. There's a whole ministry to deal with the BDS. Yeah. No, definitely. And they've succeeded in convincing parliaments around the world to legislate against the BDS, which is all a sign that it's effective.
Mm.
All I'm saying is that effectiveness in the end of the day should mean...
Change.
Yeah. And lifting the oppression, and we are not there yet.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the right movement. You're on the right side of history if you support BDS, that's for sure.
And you know something else I wanted to ask you? You know, I think you're branded as anti-Semitic for...
Mm-hmm.
And obviously you're not. You're anti-Zionist, you know. And how
right.
would you sort of describe that to somebody who doesn't quite understand the differences
yeah,
between
that's,
the two?
Yeah, that's a very important distinction. Actually, I'm a Jew, so I can't be.
Exactly.
but I think it's very... It's one of those issues where I said before, if you try to do it in a soundbite, it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to explain to people the difference between ideology, which is Zionism, and religion, which is Judaism. So when you attack Zionism, you challenge an ideology. You don't challenge a faith.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't accept Christian supremacy ideas in the United States that view African Americans as an inferior race, it doesn't mean you're against Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
It means you're against this ideology, this racist ideology that some Christians are upholding. Similar, that some Muslims who uphold an ideology that does not allow other Muslims to live.
That's right.
And that's, again, you are not against Islam, you're against that particular ideology. In fact, if you are anti-Zionist, it means that you are against racism.
Mm.
And you cannot be accused of being racist if you are against racism. It's ridiculous. it's an equation that does not... cannot work if you examine the facts. And then if you have enough time to expand a little bit the picture for people, you can show them easily that there are a lot of Jews who are not Zionists. In fact, most of the ultra-Orthodox Jews around the world are not Zionists.
Mm.
And there are a lot of Zionists who are not Jews who are actually quite anti-Semitic, because there is a certain commonality of interest between anti-Semites in Europe and America who don't want to see Jews among them.
That's right.
And like the idea of the Jews being in Palestine, because it means they won't be in their own community.
It's not their problem.
Exactly. And I think it's not surprising that some of the leaders of the extreme right wing in the West are great supporters of Israel, but anti-Semites. You know, recently I was in Greece. There are two ministers in the Greek government that on paper are Holocaust deniers. I mean, they're known as Holocaust deniers, but they're great supporters of Israel. There is no contradiction in their mind between being anti-Jewish and being pro-Israeli. So I think that if these accusations are being thrown at you, you need to be very calm and explain exactly that anti-Zionism is anti-racism and anti-Semitism is just another form of racism. So you cannot be for it because you are against all kinds of racism, not just against Jews, against anyone. But Israel weaponizes anti-Semitism as the main idea of stifling debates on Israel and Palestine.
I can imagine if they heard this interview, that's exactly what.
Oh, they would immediately brand you as anti-Semite, not just me. So yeah, that goes. It's kind of a guts reaction.
Yeah. I'm afraid we're running out of time, Professor. But I know you've written numerous books, and where can we get our hands on them, or how can we keep in touch with the research that you're doing and the work that you're doing?
Right. First of all, my center in Exeter has a website. So if you just go into the European Center of Palestine Studies in Exeter University, or if you browse my name with Exeter, everything I did in life would immediately appear on your screen.
Okay.
Although I don't have an official website, I have a public page on the Facebook. But it's very easy to access my YouTube appearances. And for its sins, Amazon has all my books as well. So I think it's quite easy to get hold of more information for anyone who wants to.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much for joining
me
today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
I've been speaking today to Professor Ilan Papier. He's a historian and an activist. He's the director of the European Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter. And we were discussing his decades-long work, actually, in reframing the Israel-Palestine conflict. If you miss any part of this interview or any previous Live and Learn interviews, you can search for the podcast on our BFM app, which is available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.